From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, we're rebroadcasting some of our favorite conversations. Actress Rhea Seehorn talks about the new season of the AMC hit series Better Call Saul. And Oscar-winning screenwriter John Ridley discusses his latest documentary, Let It Fall, Los Angeles, 1982 to 1992. But first, John W. Dean served as counsel to President Richard Nixon from 1970 until 1973. He later, of course, testified against his former boss to the Senate Watergate Committee. He's also a best-selling author of several books, including The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. John Dean has expressed his concerns about President Trump, calling his attitude toward the press more Nixonian than Nixon. He joins us now to tell us more.
Good to have you back.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Let me jump right in. What are the similarities, take your time, that you see between Richard Nixon and Donald Trump?
Well, the similarities are most striking that happened behind closed doors with Nixon versus Trump. Mm-hmm. They have very similar authoritarian type personalities, but Trump is out on the street with it. He's on the camera with it. He mm-hmm. actually campaigned on it. Nixon, his authoritarianism really was, if we didn't have the tapes, the secret mm-hmm. tapes he made, we wouldn't know the extent of it. But they're two very similar personalities, one public, one private. Nixon was a shy man in many regards. Trump is anything but shy. But I also see a huge difference in them, because Nixon came into that office experienced. He was knowledgeable about the office. He'd been in the House of Representatives, been in the Senate, been vice president for 8 years, and he'd been a practicing lawyer. He'd actually argued a couple cases before the Supreme Court. So he knew Washington. He knew the way government works. I don't think Donald Trump has a good newspaper knowledge. He's learning on the job. He's learning the hard way. He hasn't brought in a really seasoned staff. I find that a little frightening, Tavis.
Let me start with the authoritarianism. And to your point, Nixon's was more behind the scenes, Trump's more in our face. What does it say about the two men or about the times that we live that he can be so authoritarian in our faces with glee almost?
I did a book called Conservatives Without Conscience, mm-hmm. and it was a study of authoritarianism, and that personality type we got interested in after World War II and in the late stages of the war. People, particularly researchers, couldn't understand how intelligent people in Germany and Italy had been attracted to people like Mussolini and Hitler. What was in their nature? Began really looking at it. So we have, when I wrote that book, now we have about 70 years, 60 years when I did that book, of studying these types of people. And they're about, best guesstimates, somewhere between 25% and 30% of the population are authoritarians. Now, that there are two types of authoritarians, mm-hmm. to get down in the weeds just a little bit.
Let's go.
They're what they call social dominators. That's what Trump is. He's the guy that jumps out in front of everybody else, says, follow me, only I can solve this problem, only I can lead you to the promised land, mm-hmm. whatever. And then most people, however, that have authoritarian personalities are followers. They want a daddy figure. Mm-hmm. They want somebody who will take the fear of life away from them and lead them and tell them what to do, how to think, what have you. Best guesstimates from the social scientists I talked to before the Trump election thought about 25%, maybe as many as 30% of the population. Most of them are Republicans. There are a few Democrats, mm-hmm. but they're rare, fall in that category of authoritarian followers. Well, I never thought they could win the presidency, because I didn't think there were enough of them. Mm-hmm. But it just happens that a lot of them are in the swing states, and you work the Electoral College, and you can clearly win the presidency with that kind of personality. And that's the core of his followers.
Mm. But when there's evidence that suggests that he is leading them astray, that we're not headed, in fact, to the promised land, that some of the campaign promises that he made, he's broken within the first 100 days, including bombing of Syria. I could go on and on and on. They don't see the light then?
You know, it's a blind faith, mm-hmm. if you will. They're convinced that he knows best, that daddy knows best, that he may or may not be doing things immediately they want. At some point, they may well say he's not what we thought he was. Mm-hmm. He's a con. That's what I happen to think he is, mm-hmm. Even for them. But, you know, they'll follow a long way, these people. They'll go to the bitter end. We've seen it.
Yeah. How do you think, I'm still fascinated by this distinct difference you made between Nixon's behind the scenes authoritarianism, Trump's more, you know, out front. How do you think his authoritarianism is working behind the scenes? We've discussed how we see it in our faces, but how's it working behind the scenes in the White House?
I think he's a lot more angry behind. I think he's, if he seems to be checking one of his personality traits, it's anger. Mm-hmm. Occasionally we've seen little flares of it, mm-hmm. but not like I'm sure it is behind the scenes when he lets it rip. Mm-hmm. He's got an angry personality. People who have worked with him and for him speak to the nature of his anger, mm-hmm. and how ugly it can get. So I think that's what we're not seeing in his personality. Mm-hmm. How that, you know, one of the telling things to me about people who play the game of golf is how they report their golf. Golf, as you know, is a game where you take life the way it comes to you. Mm-hmm. You take that ball wherever it goes. These pros go out and just played the Masters and what have you. Mm-hmm. If they happen to touch the ball, they'll penalize themselves. It's mm-hmm. a game of self-honor and what have you. Trump claims he's got a 2.8 handicap. I was a competitive golfer in school. I don't play anymore, but mm-hmm. I know the game well. Well, I looked at that swing. That is not a 2.8 swing. That is just not.
So he's lying about that too, huh?
There's just nothing he won't leave alone.
Yeah, yeah. How do people inside the White House work with a figure like that? You work with Richard Nixon in the White House. So how do you, is it like walking on eggshells? Can you only tell him what he wants to hear? Is his way or the highway? Like, how do you work with a figure like that in the White House?
I didn't know about Nixon's authoritarianism until long after mm-hmm. I was in there. I went to work for an image of a man who I thought he was. I don't really meet him until I'm there a couple of years. I'm only in general staff meetings with the president, very few one-on-ones. Post-Watergate, after the arrests at the Watergate, it's 8 months before he starts calling on me. And because his top aides that were handling it, his chief of staff, Bob Haldeman, and his top domestic advisor, John Ehrlichman, mm-hmm. He wants them to work on his second term. He's been reelected. He wants to get some new energy, some new plans, a new reorganization going. So he knows that they've been working through me to get information about what's going on and how we can deal with this. And so he takes them out and starts dealing with me. And that's when I really get to know him. Mm-hmm. But Travis, it really isn't until I go in and tell him there's a cancer on his presidency. After about 8 meetings, I realize I don't know how much he knows or how much he doesn't know. Today, because of this book, where I transcribed every single Watergate conversation to follow the thread, I know he was lying to me. He was pretending to not know things he clearly knew. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that at the time, so I'm somewhat ginger, but in my dealings with him, it's the first time I really get to know who he is. His personality starts to come through. His moral compass is kind of bare and showing when I try to convince him that mm-hmm. the cover-up needs to end, that people are going to commit perjury. And he'll say, for example, he said, well, John, perjury is a tough rap to prove. I said, you know, they're demanding money, these guys, no telling how much they'll want. He said, well, John, how much could they ask for? And I pulled out of thin air what I thought was a figure that would offend him. I said, well, Mr. President, it could, for all I know, cost $1 million. His response is, John, that's no problem. I know where we can get $1 million. So I'm not carrying the argument. In an hour and 50-minute conversation, I took him through all these horribles. And this is, I think, the first day I really met Richard Nixon. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't what I expected. Mm.
So we know from the record, from your record and others, that Richard Nixon lied to his staff.
Yes.
We know, at least on one occasion, Bill Clinton lied to his staff. Yes. About the Monica Lewinsky scandal. He eventually later confessed to that, but he initially lied to his own staff, his own cabinet.
I think you can take and transpose that where you're going.
I was about to ask, do you think that, but here's the trick for me, though. Do you think that Donald Trump is lying to his staff or leaving things out in conversations with them, or the other way around? Because there are a number of examples involving Mr. Bannon, for example, where the president was signing stuff that he, you know, we were told from the press that he didn't know what he was signing in some of these stacks of papers. So is he leaving them in the dark? Are they leaving him in the dark, or both?
Well, he is not the kind of president we know that's going to go through a briefing book and really understand what he's doing.
Right.
So he's got to rely on his staff, mm-hmm. and they know that. So there may be many things slipping into these documents that are getting signed, some where there's public fanfare, some that are just quietly being signed and are routine business.
Well, pushing their agenda, though.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So we don't know what's going on there. But we do know there's some have surfaced, Bannon and the National mm-hmm. Security Council,
sure.
where he put himself on and, mm-hmm. and apparently didn't have any kind of real discussion with the president before he did it. But I think Trump is also, he apparently likes the competition within his staff. He thinks that generates ideas. I think it generates chaos. Mm-hmm. But apparently he ran a small family business of what turned out to be a large corporate, in a sense, because mm-hmm. of the value of the assets involved, organization. But it's not impossible to run the White House that way. It's not the way traditionally it's been run, but other presidents have relied on family, and they certainly have had kitchen cabinets and mm-hmm. private advisors, so that's not unusual. What's unusual is this man just doesn't know anything about what he's doing. Most people who've come to that office have really understood the office. They know why they want the office. When Barack Obama became president, my only concern was his lack of experience. Mm-hmm. It clearly took him a couple years to learn the job. But he was dedicated to doing that. Mm-hmm. I mean, took big books at home every night and read them and prepared himself and got into the issues. Well, that's not going to happen with this man. He's 70 years of age. His pattern is set. The good part is he doesn't know what all he can do.
Trump is a winner. He's used to winning. He loves to win at golf, whether he lies about it or not. He loves to win these bids and these deals.
I'm told when he plays golf, they call a guy who played golf with him said
yeah.
his nickname is Pele. And I said, why do you call him that? He said, because he kicks the ball all the time.
Yeah, better lie. That's my favorite soccer player. I used to love Pele. So here's the thing. So if Trump is a winner and loves to win, and at some point realizes that if he keeps going down the path he's on, he will go down not just as a failed president, but as one of the worst presidents in history. I can't believe a guy with that ego could tolerate that. He does not want to go down as one of the worst presidents. So if for no other reason, the fact he just wants to win and get some points on the scoreboard, maybe he changes his ways.
I think that is a hope also, that he will realize he needs competent people around him, that he's got some people who have that potential and who are learning quick and will come up the learning curve quickly. The people who he took from Goldman Sachs are not, they're not duds. Mm-hmm. They're bright people, and they'll learn. They'll figure out that system quickly. But they're doing it the hard way. They didn't come in with other people they could turn to and say, how do we do this, how do that? They're having to sort of reinvent the wheel along the way at this point.
Yeah. So we know.
But I think that's a good point, that his desire to win could be a self-restraint on some of the craziness that might otherwise happen.
Yeah, that's. I mean, I'm grasping for possibilities, but that's the only one there for me, because everything else you said about him, I totally agree with, but I just can't imagine. I mean, if it were me, you know, and I'd gotten myself in a situation, I don't want to go down as the worst president.
Well,
ever.
He's already started as the worst president.
Yeah, that's my point. At some point, he wants to make a U-turn, I would think.
You would hope.
Yeah.
You know, what the other frightening thing, though, is like bombing Syria, where he did 180 degrees from what appeared to be a belief. Did he do that just to get his ratings up? Because he certainly got a positive feedback, and he's smart enough to know what works for the media.
And he's the master of distraction.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so just by throwing bombs out there, starting a war somewhere, he changes the conversation.
Yeah.
He's got a ship on its way to the waters outside of North Korea. That's a pretty dangerous place to go.
Yeah.
And if this is just diversion, or... He's also a risk taker.
Yeah.
He's somebody who will take a risk. We know that. He's risk and loss. We don't know how many ventures he's been in that have really gone bad, because we don't know His tax records are not available. His business records are really not available. But I, when he first, Tavis, looked like he was going to get the nomination, I happened to be having lunch with a lawyer who'd been in litigation, maybe 15 or so cases with him, a New Jersey lawyer. I was giving a talk. And this guy said, I've had him in depositions, and he's the one who really first, before a lot of his litigation had become public and made public by USA Today as the first one that broke the story. He had like 3,900 cases. He's plaintiff in 1,300 and the rest are all, he's the defendant. Well, this guy was one of the guys who had been sued by Trump, and what his clients were sued by is he was just trying to cut them off and not pay them, mm-hmm. and litigate rather than settle up, mm-hmm. at the end of a contract. He said he lies, he cheats and steals. He it's his business practice. And these people, none of them have ever gone back in business with him, but I, because I'd represented several of them, I ended up more of these clients. He said, this is not a good man.
Yeah. Back to your point about what he's done in Syria, how scared are you about where we might be headed in that particular region of the world?
Well, it's a region of the world that there are no simple answers. I don't think putting a 36-year-old real estate heir in charge of this is going to solve the Middle East, mm-hmm. problems. All good luck and good wishes for Mr. Kushner, but wouldn't have been my top choice if I had that kind of power to put somebody in on that issue. It is a problem that has to be solved. We have to be more a part of it. We have to open our borders and for these kinds of refugees and bring them in and show them the good side of America. That side of his policy doesn't match with his sudden care for babies from Syria that now have got his attention.
Well, this is the issue that Hillary Clinton kept raising all the time in those commercials and her speeches. Do you want this guy to have the nuclear codes? Is this the guy you want to be making military decisions? And in the first 100 days, here we go.
Well, also, he pretty much, his bombing of the airfield is pretty much what Hillary recommended back in October, mm-hmm. of last year, mm-hmm. and his response to that was, that'll start World War III.
Exactly.
Well, indeed, is that his plan? Does he see this leading to, yeah. World War? Hopefully not.
Yeah. So
that'll certainly divert attention from the Russia story.
Yeah, that's one way to get attention off of it. We know, obviously, what led to the ultimate downfall of Richard Nixon, your former boss. We know what his undoing was.
Lying. More lying than anything else.
Okay, I take that. So, you know the question. Of all the things that could trip up Donald Trump, what's going to trip him up?
I think his lies are going to catch him. He has taken lying during the campaign and during his presidency to a level that we're all baffled by, that anybody thinks they can get away with this indefinitely and think it's not going to come back and haunt him. He's also, lying was what got Bill Clinton in trouble.
Sure, sure.
And that's what he was impeached for.
It's rarely the act, it's always the lie.
Exactly. So, some of these civil lawsuits, let's say he escapes. Say the Republicans keep control of Congress for 4 years and don't want to touch him. But what could? Some of these civil suits are not all going to go away. That's one of the big arguments that'll have to be decided probably by the Supreme Court. Now, the Paula Jones case involving Bill Clinton said a civil lawsuit started before he was president can follow him into the presidency, and indeed that's what he was impeached on, was his false statements during a deposition in the Paula Jones lawsuit. Well, I don't know what's going to happen, although the Trump looks now like he's got a Supreme Court that'll be solidly 5-4 him, but there's one, Justice Kennedy could go either way on many of these issues, still back and forth. But if I see him getting tripped up on anything, it's going to be on his dissembling. That is just, he is desecrating the office he's a part of with his lying.
Yeah. What about the business dealings? I mean, I take your point. He could get caught lying about any number of things, but separate and apart from that, how scared are you about And there are many people who believe, in fact, he's going to get tripped up on these business deals.
I think, we don't know, but I think he's making a lot of money as president. He's pumping his businesses. He's using his hotel. He goes over and has dinner there. He's using Mar-a-Lago. He's doubled the cost of the memberships. He's got a country club over in Northern Virginia that he's now actively using that to play golf. Most presidents always played at Burning Tree. He's got his own country club I don't know if the course is as good as Burning Tree or not. I've not talked to anybody who's played them both recently. But I think his business dealings, eventually it's going to seep out. The truth has its own way of kind of bubbling up to the surface. And what's encouraging is that he has done more for journalism than the past 10 presidents, because he's theater. There's a true element of theater about this. It's a little frightening. I don't think we need the presidency to be a theatrical reality show, but we're getting that.
What's the end game, or what do you think the final result will be of his unrelenting attacks on the media?
He will lose that game. They're more of them than him. It's the old argument of not getting into a fight with somebody who buys ink by the barrel. Now there are more digital outlets than there are presidential words to deal with them. And he can try to poison the press with calling them the enemies of the American people, but the American people are too savvy to buy into that. They know. I mean, yes, it'll play well with his base, but his base isn't very big. And the crowd he really wants to impress are his fellow Manhattanites and people like that. That's what he's really trying, and he's not impressing them, and mm-hmm. that will cause its own problem.
Has he, since he's the standard bearer for your party now, has he changed your
party? Well, I'm not, in here in California, yeah. you know, we cannot declare
of
either
course.
One, so I'm really in that. I don't declare a party, yeah. and I have voted for both.
Yeah, so forget the question about your party affiliation. I guess the question I was wanted to get to, the point I wanted to get to
Frankly,
was...
Frankly, I'd be embarrassed to carry that label right now.
Has he changed your politics?
I have not changed my politics.
Because of him?
No.
Okay.
Or because of Nixon.
Okay.
I've sort of stayed where I was, which today puts me well left of center. Mm-hmm. I have to be called a social liberal by almost any definition.
Okay.
On some economic issues, I'm still pretty centrist to conservative.
Mm-hmm.
I recently was the Goldwater chair of American institutions at Arizona State. I held that chair for a full term mm-hmm. over there and taught a course. They didn't give me the chair because of my liberal beliefs, but Goldwater today is way left of center, too.
Point well taken. John Dean's latest book in paperback now is called The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. The parallels between Richard Nixon and Donald J. Trump are astonishing. We will see how this all plays out in the coming months and years and see if John Dean is right, that what ultimately gets Mr. Trump are the lies. John Dean, good to have you back, my friend.
Thank you, Travis.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. The third season of AMC's hit show Better Call Saul started on April 10. The show is the spinoff prequel of Breaking Bad and centers around the life of a small-town lawyer, Jimmy McGill, who eventually becomes the ruthless and infamous Saul Goodman. Ray Sehorn plays Kim Wexler, an ambitious attorney who has a complicated relationship with Jimmy McGill. Before the conversation begins, here's a clip from Better Call Saul.
I'll do the wills.
No, you won't.
Of course I will do the wills. They're my clients.
They're my clients. You and I aren't partners, remember? Once I take these people on, I can't just reassign them to you.
Oh, come on. Why are you getting all, like, legal on me, huh? Who cares?
Look, I told every single one of them the situation, that they'd be getting me instead of you. I tried to talk them all into coming back another day. Six of them left. Maybe you'll get those back. And look, if this is about the money...
It's not about the money. You can keep the money.
Don't act like I wanted this. Jeez, like I need more on my plate.
Are we having fun yet?
Right?
Yeah. For those who haven't seen this, this is a prequel.
Yes.
To Breaking Bad.
Yes.
How far back are we going?
I'm always trying to do the exact math, but I think it falls between five and a half years prior. But we've already seen them be elastic with the timeline they've gone past Breaking Bad and our prequel as well, back to mailroom scenes and stuff.
I want to ask this question about, I guess there are two parts to it. What's the fun part or what's the challenge of starring in a prequel to a series that everybody knows?
Right. Well, I mean, certainly there's parts of it that were daunting. I was a huge Breaking Bad fan. And the plus with so many great shows that come out is that there was a reason to get eyeballs on this. I mean, there's no mistaking the fact that it's a great thing that there was a fan base there that's interested in what Vince Gilligan and Peter Gould want to write, as well as Bob Odenkirk and Jonathan Banks is continuing their character stories. But yeah, it can be daunting, and you can think, you can also have fans hate something just because it's not, why isn't this Breaking Bad season six? Do you know what I mean? And in the end, I think that it's, I think it's a great thing that they made sure it isn't just Breaking Bad season six. It's its own thing. And there's certainly nods to Breaking Bad, and there's no mistaking the quality of that type of writing and that multi-layered, assume the intelligence of your audience. But it is its own tone and it is its own pace. I have the benefit of there not being an expectation, you know, for who Kim was and where she's going. Plus, we learn about our characters. I learn the new characters. You learn about them as almost at the same pace that the audience does. The scripts come one at a time. And you know, when I played that first smoking garage, parking garage scene, smoking with Jimmy. In the pilot, they just said they've known each other for 10 years and we're not sure exactly how and why and on what level, but there's an extreme intimacy and confidence between the two. And that's what we played. You know what I mean? And you just kind of unpeel that layer with everybody else.
Testing your thespian chops.
It's fun.
Yeah.
It's fun.
It's like a high wire though.
It is a little bit, and they and Peter and Vince and the whole amazing writing staff, they talk about the fact that they are constantly painting themselves into corners and hoping they can get out. It's one of the only shows that does not have a Bible, meaning an extensive outline for not just the series, but not even season by season. They have ideas, and clearly this is a prequel, so this one definitively has endpoints to deal with, but. But yeah, they like to leave a little bit of it organic while constantly planting these very detailed seeds that are blooming and growing, you know, in the background. And you go back to them and you're like, I remember, oh yes, that seed was planted a while ago. And everyone, myself included, is transfixed by that sort of strange organic unveiling of story and character.
Let me step outside of the character Kim for a second and just ask you, Ray, whether or not you liked the idea of being on that high wire. You like being in a situation playing a character where from week to week you don't know where this thing is going?
Yes. I mean, it can be terrifying. But in other ways, this particular role has forced me to get back to what any actor that you would talk to would tell you is the key to the best acting you could do would be to be present in the moment. Because your character shouldn't actually know what's happening around the corner. And yes, there's some awareness when we're working on our craft and our stories of what is the arc here and what is the journey so that you can make the most dramatic beginning, middle, and end that you can. But this is a little different. And it is a high wire act, but I think the reason it doesn't feel scary is because of Vince Gilligan and Peter Gould. It doesn't feel manipulative. It doesn't feel like they know and they're not telling you and they want to see you dance as fast as you can trying to figure it out. It feels more like this is an organic world. I remember I had a scene in season one, where Jimmy is calling me from Chuck's house. Chuck is still very ill and hasn't been practicing law for a long time. And Jimmy's very excited that Chuck has agreed to work on the Sandpiper case with him. And he calls Kim at her office and asks her to look something up on the Westlaw terminal as well as print some things out. And he's very excited that his brother wants to work with him, is feeling healthier, and for them to have a reason to bond. And the script just had that Kim hesitates. And it just had a bunch of ellipses and barely any words. And then I start asking some really kind of just innocuous but tedious questions of, well, I don't know. I don't have my printer code. They're going to bill me. They have to bill you. And he's like, great, great. I'll go get the printer code from Chuck. And he does. I'm like, well, I'm supposed to be somewhere. I just keep saying weird things and hesitating. And so I went to them and I asked them and I said, well, so do I know? And at this time, I, like many people, was sort of projecting onto the Hamlin character that he's pulling the strings and he somehow has a personal vendetta with Jimmy, not suspecting Chuck. I thought there's something deep under that relationship surface, but I didn't get why she was being that way. And they said, we're not sure. We just think she has a weird feeling in her gut about him. And so do we. And that's where we're living right now. And it was like, but how do I play that? And I thought, you just play that.
Yeah.
And that is exactly what happens in real life so often. And I played that, and it was amazing to just let go and just play that.
That requires you. It's one thing to trust your fellow actors, but this requires like an extreme amount of trust in your writing staff.
Yes.
Yeah.
But like many people that have now seen the glorious work of these writers, that part wasn't hard.
Yeah.
Bob had said the same thing when people said, like, were you afraid to do a prequel? And he said, not if Vince Gilligan and Peter Gould say they want to do it. Because those guys are only going to do something if they know this is a tale they want to tell, that they're going to put everything into. So yeah, there's an extreme amount of trust all around, the crew too. I mean, it's crazy now with HD and binge watching and the avid fans. I remember starting in theater and even beginning in television a decade ago, if you had a newspaper on a desk, props people could write Latin on it, because you can't read it. Our fans freeze frame and do a close up. People are writing full articles on the staff, and they're doing my diploma specifically, if it's on the wall in the background. Every post-it is filled out, and they're really good forgers now. Everyone on that crew knows how to do my handwriting, which is sort of scary. Kim has a lot of post-its, so
I guess I can't ask you where your character is headed, because you don't, like, really know.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Thank God, because I'm not great at secrets. I mean, at least I can keep under wraps what I know for episode 1 through 10 of this season. But I couldn't tell you where she ends up.
Yeah.
I don't think it's dyed in the wool yet.
Do you have ideas or interest in where you'd like to see this relationship go?
Yes and no. Yeah. I'm enjoying how authentic it is and the sort of discovery of what that authenticity looks like. Playing a relationship that a lot of people, even with its bizarre circumstance and sort of extreme characters, it still remains an incredibly accessible relationship. And I love when people have come up to Bob and I and talked about, I love that, you know, it looks like a real relationship. It looks like those who really actually, you know, have a foundation of love and respect for each other. When you're talking about these two people. But some of it just comes from things like being able to leave the room mad. A lot of times on television, you have to resolve an argument within the scene. Or people are very worried. And instead, the takeaway people have been having is, oh yeah, no, I've totally told my partner to just get away from me. And I know that you're gonna be there at breakfast. And that's that's 10 years. That's what 10 years looks like.
You like the idea of playing a lawyer with these sort of moral dilemmas?
I do.
When
I first found out that the character was a lawyer, I presumed, and I was right, it doesn't happen often, but I was right that they weren't going to do a procedural. This was not going to be a law show about doing a different court case each time, that it was more probably going to be about humans that happen to practice law and what that does to them. So I was talking to my manager, Alyssa Vredenberg, who I know went to law school, and I said, can you recommend, I don't even know where to begin. I can't get a law degree before I go down to Albuquerque to shoot. But I want a sense of what it does to somebody to study law. And she said, Scott Turow's, his groundbreaking book, 1L, from 1972. Did you read this?
I've read parts of it,
It's so great. It's a memoir of him being a first year Harvard Law student. And yes, there's a lot of stuff about tort law and legalese and some sort of technical things that were helpful to read through and get an understanding of. But for the most part, it's about how studying law and then choosing or not choosing to practice law deeply affects the person that's doing it. And that idea of really getting your brain to understand that good and bad is not the same as legal and illegal. And it's definitely not the same as moral and immoral or ethical and unethical. And that has been the baseline and the touchstone that I keep going back to, and it has served me very well as Kim, because I very much think that is difficult for her to get her head around.
And I know a lot of folk who get tripped up by that, by those distinctions.
Yes.
And many people who end up no longer practicing law.
And that's what
because
he's,
they can't, and that's what Terrell was going with.
100%. That challenge came up in season two for Kim of keeping the Mesa Verde case.
Yeah.
I think she's struggling, and she struggles in a very particular way with those kind of guilty consciences in this season.
Well, fortunately, you're an actor, so when the day's over, you can just leave it there.
I wish.
And you ain't got to really deal with that.
No, my fiance just deals with me talking about it endlessly. What would you do?
I will put him higher on my prayer list then. How about that? Ray, good to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Better Call Saul is the project in season three. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. John Ridley is the Oscar-winning screenwriter of the film 12 Years a Slave. He's been hard at work on several new projects, a documentary called Let It Fall, Los Angeles 1982 to 1992, which explores the 1992 uprising, and the Showtime series Guerrilla, which focuses on the British Black Power movement of the 1970s. Before our conversation, here now a clip from Let It Fall, Los Angeles 1982 to 1992.
It's not a protest anymore. Now it's a full-blown riot.
Anybody that wasn't black was getting their ass kicked.
One of those days, compassion was, it wasn't handed out to other races.
I was in the boxing gym telling my guys that you were coming on the program, and you could almost sense the shock from the guys in the gym when I reminded them that this is the 25th anniversary. It was just hard for people to process that was 25 years ago. How did you feel digging into this 25 years later?
It was odd. I had just moved out to Los Angeles. You know, 25 years, when you think about a quarter of a century, that this is not just history anymore, it's moving towards ancient history. Mm-hmm. You know, this is past my kids' time. There are people you meet, they barely remember the uprising, let alone the events around it. To a lot of people, it's just become, you know, Rodney King, Reginald Denny, and that's it. And what we wanted to do, what we hoped to do, was not just put that night or that year into some kind of context, but to say there was a wider context. You know, we could have gone back 15 years, 25 years, but with at least 10 years and say these events and these circumstances, it wasn't just one thing. It didn't just happen to one community. People didn't just react one way. Mm-hmm. Made a very interesting comment about that. But that's what we want to approach in the documentary, is to say there were a lot of things going on, and there are a lot of reasons why they were going on.
How does that context, that broader context, John, inform the story that you do tell?
For me, you know, look, having just moved out here, not being an Angeleno originally, coming from New York, which was, when I left, it was Bernie Goetz and Howard Beach and Crown Heights and a lot of things that really informed my perspective. 25 years later, to say, well, it's a lot less about me or what I think or what I remember and a lot more about trying to provide a space for people to have their own recollections and talk about what happened. Because 25 years later, I get to move on or have different opinions or different perspectives. For the people that we talked to, 25 years ago was 5 minutes ago. It was 5 hours ago. And to sit this far away from individuals from all different backgrounds and have them tell their stories and share it with an emotion that was so immediate. You know, I've been very fortunate to have been able to express bits of history, whether it's Red Tails or 12 Years a Slave. But a lot of that, you know, it's still my expression of someone else's history. A documentary is very different. Yeah. It's creating a space where individuals get to express their recollections for themselves.
I was struck by the former LAPD officer, the white woman, on the clip a moment ago, who said that if you weren't black, you were getting your behind kicked.
Yeah.
All right. It's a bit of an exaggeration. Not everybody who wasn't black got their behind kicked, but I take her point. But it leads me to ask whether or not, when one sees this documentary, whether or not, not to put you in the seat of judging how white people will view this, but generally speaking, broadly speaking, when they see this, are they going to leave celebrating and reveling in the humanity of black people or further demonizing black people?
I hope that they look at the humanity of all people, but certainly people of color, because there are going to, look, there are going to be people who arrive to this, or quite frankly, anything I do, I've learned, with their agendas already in place.
Sure.
But within this space, I think we have enough voices and enough perspectives and see enough people that reacted in their own ways that they will not walk away saying, well, those people only did that, or they did that. There's a reason why, for me now, at least in this space, why we're not using the word riot here. And I don't ever want to get into a war of semantics. People can use this word or can't use that word. But this was not something that happened spontaneously overnight because of one thing. Over this period of 10 years, we can see individuals who tried to engage in the system, who tried to get recourse, who tried to call attention to issues, who put up with a lot of things up until a moment where individuals felt there was no other way to express themselves. And even that didn't begin spontaneously just because of the verdict. There were other incidences. So I think and believe, without explaining exactly what happens at the end, that there are going to be moments where people will see their humanity. But ultimately, all we can do is build an apparatus for delivering empathy and how people walk away, you know, whether it's one community, whether it's people in uniform or out of uniform or other communities. All we can do is say, look, these are the bodies of stories.
As you know, I worked for Tom Bradley when he was mayor of this city, and I was there when that ugly tension existed between the mayor and Daryl Gates, born, from my perspective at least, largely of the disrespect that Chief Gates had for the mayor of this city, Tom Bradley. That's my own personal assessment. What then of the other actors in this drama over that 10-year period, beyond the folks who we saw in the streets?
We see police officers, we see people from the black community, not just from South Central. I mean, one of the things, I think a lot of people who've never been to Los Angeles couldn't tell you where Foothill was, couldn't tell you where South Central, Westwood, Koreatown. We want to get all of those various communities, and over time, but also look at moments in LA, you know, going from 82 to 92, to be able to look at least in the documentary version, in the full-length version, you know, 1984, and look at Tom Bradley, and look at what he meant to the city, look at what his vision, how it actually helped change the city. In moments where there was a better LA, completely inevitable, but under the surface, whether it's Los Angeles or other cities, and we don't necessarily want to draw a direct comparison, but if we're not looking at every aspect of it, if we're just looking at the facade, then we're missing these other things
and,
that
and
are happening.
Not to cut you off, the reference to 84, the Olympics are in L.A.
The Olympics, 84, Tom Bradley, how he changed the city, how he inspired people, you know, not just as a man of color, but as a man of vision, I mean, as you know.
Are there takeaways 25 years later?
I hope the takeaway, almost like you said, more than anything, is the humanity of individuals and not the broad painting. I mean, there were things that I saw on television 25 years ago that I had a very immediate, very visceral response to without a sense of context. Now, even with context, I or anybody may walk away and go, well, you know what, I still feel the same way, but can I at least see the complicated nature of how those things were arrived to? So what we don't want to do, what I'm not trying to do is say, well, you know, L.A. is Ferguson, or Cincinnati, or is Baltimore, or say that this individual, that's all they are. What you saw then is all they are now. But hopefully for people to walk away and go, oh, you know what, I can see the complicated nature. I can see that this person arrived to a circumstance, or quite frankly, is removed from a circumstance because they are a human being. I think we're gonna break hearts, but I really hope at the same time we do lift spirits.
The thing I love about you, and I say this to you, to your face, I've said it about you 1,000 times, absent your presence, but I so regard and so respect the fact that somebody told me years ago, it's not about the work you do, it's about the work you get done. All of us are doing work, but it's the work you get done. And you're getting it done, and you're being able to tell these stories, these human dramas, again, that we all need to wrestle with. And because I know you are so serious about representing, as we say in the hood, you always believe in representing. How does it feel when you get pushback for representing? The Guerrilla Project is a wonderful project, but I've been reading, of course, some pushback. How does that feel? How do you process getting pushback when your whole
modus operandi is to represent.
It's, you know, I would never say that negativity is ever easy to deal with, mm-hmm. or that you know, as much as you want to remove yourself from things, that things don't come to you. But I think negativity has got to be the first thing that you learn to deal with, mm-hmm. because otherwise you're never going to get anywhere. But I wouldn't be sitting here if other people hadn't given me the opportunity, or quite frankly, many opportunities to try to tell any story in particular. And over those years, to be able to tell stories like Red Tails, to be able to tell stories like 12 Years, to be able to work with people like Lupita or Regina or whatever, for me personally, I would feel somewhat irresponsible if at some point I didn't open that up. And not just with people like Frida, but people like Richard Cabral or Bettino Martinez or anyone that has an experience that's somewhat different than mine. That's difficult when you're looking at individuals and they cannot see their experience in other people's experience. It's difficult for anyone. It's also difficult, you know, honestly, when it was coming from very young people, because, you know, I've got kids. Mm-hmm. And I want them to understand their experience. I want them to understand, I believe W.E.B. Du Bois called it, you know, our particular troubles. Mm-hmm. You know, and our troubles are very particular. But at that same time, if I'm not creating some kind of space where they're going to hopefully 5, 6, 10 years from now be other individuals who feel comfortable and feel appropriate telling their story, then I think I've done something wrong. Because I got to tell you, with 3 shows, with American Crime, Guerrilla, Let It Fall, for me, I think there's a lot of space in there for a lot of representation.
Is there comedians who've told jokes about this, that the Academy Award is almost a curse for Negroes? But it seems that either the award has worked for you, or put another way, you have made the award work for you.
I understand exactly what you're saying. And I would say almost for anybody, that award, I mean, look, that it's the pinnacle of peer review. Mm-hmm. So what do you do next? I was very fortunate because the day after the Academy Awards that morning, I had to get on an airplane. And this is not hyperbole. Mm-hmm. The day after, get up that morning, get on an airplane, fly to Texas, and start our last week of prep for the first season of American Crime. Mm-hmm. So there was not time to even compartmentalize to the positive, to the negative, what that meant. It was showing up in Texas with a lot of amazing actors.
Mm-hmm. I am so proud to know you honored by your work, and thank you for coming to see us, my friend.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. Thank you.
I appreciate you. You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing, or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel Nsiabwadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.